All right. Good evening. It is February 15th, 2007. My name is Dana Pretzer. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen to live shows, download shows, listen to podcasts, my daily commentaries, whatever. The Dana Pretzer Show starts in just about a minute. Tonight, Commander Paul Tolan of the United States Navy. We're continuing on with our investigation of those parents that have had children abducted and taken to Japan, and Commander Tolan is one of those. His daughter, Erica, has been abducted and taken to Japan. We're going to talk about his case. After that, Dr. Mary Lou Randor, PhD, Professional Outreach Coordinator of the Animal Fighting and Cruelty Campaign for the United States Humane Society. We're going to talk about the growing problem of cat hoarding. It's a serious mental health issue. After that, Tim Miller from Texas Equisearch will discuss the recent Jody Sanderholm fundraiser and maybe get some Aruba updates from him. And talk about Aruba updates. We've got some bombshells tonight. Make sure and stay tuned. Jossie Mansour, managing editor of Daria, will be here to discuss the recent Paulus Vandersloot lawsuit against Aruba, some phone taps, and lots of stuff. Try and say that three times real fast. The Paulus Vandersloot lawsuit. Anyway, I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. Glad to have you. We'll be back in a minute or two with Commander Paul Tolan.
Certain that you love me. Every time you hold me, I'm still not certain that you care. Oh, you keep on saying you really, really, really love me. Do you speak the same words to someone else when I'm not there? Suspicion torments my heart. Suspicion keeps us apart. Suspicion, why talk to me? Every time you call me and tell me we should meet tomorrow, I can't help but think that you're meeting someone else tonight.
Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. If you're listening on the internet, it's scaredmonkeys.com/radio. We're on cable, channel 46, Trust Cable in Alabama, on satellite W3-957 on the Motorola receivers, or AMC3 transponder 7, Digicipher 2 audio. Wherever you're picking us up, it's always nice to have you. We're continuing on with our investigation into the number of parents that have had their children abducted and taken to Japan. It's a very serious problem. I've done several shows on it now. In fact, my latest daily commentary talks about that on the scaredmonkeys.com/radio webpage. Or go to scaredmonkeys.com. You'll see it there, too. And I thought I would bring on another father, another parent who's had his child, in this case, Erica, abducted and taken to Japan. Commander Paul Tolan of the United States Navy is with me tonight. Commander, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you, Dana?
I'm doing fine, sir. As I've said to several guests that I've had on the air now over the past few weeks, this is a problem that I'd never heard about, to be quite honest with you, or heard very little about, something that mainstream media has done very little coverage on. But it's a huge issue where it talks about international relationships with other countries, signatory excuses as far as why nothing can be done. And I know if I was a parent and my child was somewhere and I couldn't do anything about it, it would be very difficult to handle. Let's start out by getting you to tell my audience a little bit about your case.
Okay. I was stationed in Japan back in the early 90s, from 1993 to 1995. And while I was there, I met a Japanese woman, and we got married before I left Japan. Then we spent a number of years in the United States. And then in 1999, actually, I was stationed again in Japan. And so we moved back there to Japan again. And in 2002, we had a daughter, Erica. And in 2003, we started to have some problems with our marriage. And they're kind of, there's details to it that I don't have to go into, but,
right.
but the bottom line is we were going to marriage counseling and trying to work things out. They weren't working out. And then one day, while at work, I got a phone call from my neighbor saying, did you know that there's a moving company at your house?
Jeez.
And I got home. My wife and my daughter were gone along with all of our stuff, or a significant portion of our stuff, and she had packed up and moved to Tokyo, which was about 2 hours away from where I was, without any warning, and her mother heavily influenced this decision on her part.
Right.
And so, you know, my key concern at that point was trying to maintain some kind of relationship with my daughter and trying to repair my marriage as well.
Right.
In Japan's culture is very interesting. Once the decision's made to get a divorce, it's not like the United States where, you know, the parents get divorced, but you don't get divorced from your children. But
okay.
In Japan, when you get divorced, you're not just divorcing your spouse. You know, in many ways, you're divorcing your child as well. And that's the way the Japanese society looks at this. You break the family unit apart, and the family unit is dissolved, and no parts of it get back together. And whoever has a child, in this case my wife had my daughter, will get the custody of the child, and the other parent is expected and anticipated to not be able to see that child again. It's just an expectation within their society that differs greatly from our society.
In many domestic situations, Commander, the husband or wife have an indication or have a thought or even an idea that one of the, either they or their spouse may move out someday. And when they come home and find things gone or hear that a moving van is in front of their residence, they're not totally surprised. This doesn't sound like that to me with you. This is something that it almost sounds like you might have been set up.
I believe it's possible in some ways. I know for sure, you know, when things started to go bad in the marriage, that her mother and her were, my former mother-in-law and wife were plotting this move, and it was sort of history repeating itself, because my wife comes from a family that was divorced in Japan,
mm-hmm.
and after their divorce was done in much the same way, and my wife has not seen or heard from her father for the last 25 years, and that's just the standard expectation in Japan.
Well, culture aside, it's not that easy to just shut off your relationship with your children. Other guests that I've had on my program, we've talked about their situations. You're in a little bit of a different situation where you have the government, so to speak, at your beck and call, and that might be a bit of an exaggeration, but you have some resources with the government that others may not have had, with you being a commander in the Navy. Has that been helpful to you? Has the Navy been able to help you?
I had, and I certainly don't want to generalize anything in the Navy by talking about specific experiences, but I had a bad experience when I first went for legal help.
Okay.
But it wasn't the Navy, it was that one particular lawyer.
Okay.
And he was not helpful at all. And then I realized that I had just gotten the wrong lawyer. It's just like anywhere, you can get the wrong lawyer. And a couple of years later, when I was already back in the States, I spoke to a Navy Judge Advocate General, and she had been the head Judge Advocate in Japan. And she was very helpful and very insightful. And I wish, when I was in Japan at the time, I had gotten to speak to her instead. So, you know, but as far as the Navy and the military are limited in what they can do, because this kind of issue really falls under jurisdiction of the State Department.
Right.
You know, they can lend their support, and I will say that, you know, from a support perspective, my command and my commanding officer and my executive officer and everybody that I worked for and with were very supportive of me in anything I needed. But, you know, as far as from a policy and a big policy perspective, the issue of child abduction is a State Department issue. Now, there are some specific military things involved in my case because my daughter was abducted off a military base. And because living in Japan, I was living there under something called the Status of Forces Agreement, which is a treaty that governs our treatment and our status in Japan as military members. And so there's some unique aspects within that. But really, you know, what they generally tend to do if you're going through a divorce in Japan is they'll refer you to a civilian attorney, and it's a civilian matter. And then when if an abduction takes place, they'll refer you to the Office of Children's Issues at the State Department, because that really, it sort of goes outside of the military's jurisdiction and into the jurisdiction of the State Department. And so I haven't pushed the issue too hard within the military. I've pushed it over at the State Department because I know it is their jurisdiction.
Right. Unlike others that have been on my program, you actually got to see your daughter, although just for a couple of hours on a couple of different instances, one in particular, 16th of August, 2003. Tell us about that and how you felt.
There were two instances that I got to see her, and they were in, well, when we first separated, I got to see her until I got in an argument with my mother-in-law. That was, so I got to see her three times in the summer of 2003, immediately after the separation. But then, it wasn't working out because I wasn't getting unlimited access to her. I visited her with my ex-wife and my mother-in-law standing there watching the whole time, and it was for maybe 30 minutes.
Sure.
But then she really cut off contact about a month after the separation. That's when she cut off contact altogether. And being in Japan, she obviously had the ability to do that because the courts are very unhelpful there. And so after spending countless hours in court and countless times, countless money in court trying to get access to my daughter, I finally was able to for two courthouse visitations. And the courthouse visitations were in a playroom that I got to play with her at the courthouse.
Right.
And it was kind of humiliating because here's me, a commander in the Navy, a respected person on a base and in society, and I was being watched on one-way mirrors by my wife and her attorneys and my attorneys, and I had a court person in the room with me, as well as my wife's mother in the room with me, watching me. So and a video camera taping me.
Wow.
So my treatment, my visitation with my daughter, is something the equivalent of what a felon criminal would get with their child visitation-wise in the States.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet, I had committed no crime. I was the victim of a crime.
Yeah, for sure.
It's hard to even describe the humiliation of it. I endured it because I loved my daughter so much, and I was so happy to see her for that short period of time during those two courthouse visitations.
I guess so.
But the reason I was given was for being under such tight security, getting to see her, was that my wife was afraid that I would abduct my daughter.
Jeez.
And I made sure to correct my lawyers and everybody there and say, you mean re-abduct.
Right.
Because she's already been abducted.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't abduct something that rightfully belongs to you. You have a Japanese lawyer, or had a Japanese lawyer that was assisting you, and of course, United States lawyer. Let's talk about the legal process you went and how you filed abduction charges, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Well, we went through Japanese mediation, and it's a procedure to try to repair the marriage before you go to divorce court, and that wasn't working out. But, you know, my issue every time I went into mediation was, hey, let's talk about me getting to see my daughter while mediation is ongoing. And that never went anywhere. Mediation was this process that you can't even comprehend from here in the States, where you wait in two different waiting rooms behind frosted glass, so you can't see the other waiting room. And then my wife would go into the courthouse, and then she'd leave and go back in the waiting room, and then I'd go in the courthouse, and then I'd leave and go back in the waiting room. And we never actually saw each other face-to-face. And we never talked about any real issues. I had the issues on the table that I wanted to talk about, and none of them ever really got addressed. So it was the typical Japanese way of talking around issues without ever directly confronting them. So it's kind of hard to describe. I lived in Japan for 7 years. and it seems so foreign to most Americans that they just wouldn't even couldn't even hardly comprehend such a thing.
Right. This whole issue is, and for the record, I have contacted the Japanese equivalent of their State Department Foreign Affairs and asked them to be on the program with me, and have received no response. But believe me, if I do get them to come on the program, there will be many questions asked of them. This is just so tragic. Just looking at the timeline here, you've been denied all access to your daughter since the 23rd of August, 2003, yet you've been paying child support or putting money into a trust for her. Tell us a little bit about that procedure.
Well, it's a long procedure, but originally I was paying money directly to my ex-wife.
Right.
And I was paying it to her for 6 months and never getting to see my daughter. Every time I would say that, she'd say, well, let the court handle it. Let's leave it to the court. So finally I said, well, I'm going to withdraw that and pay it into a different account down here, a joint account that I'll hold with Erica. And when we get around to talking about child visitation issues, then I'll open that account up. And she's never come around to talking child visitation issues. And I know this sounds a little bit warped, but stay with me here, and I'll try to make you understand something.
Sure.
Although I totally disagree with what she's doing, I understand why she's doing it.
Okay.
And I understand why your previous guests, Patrick Braden and Brett Weed, why they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know, my ex-wife knows, that if she let me see my daughter without any supervision, that I could re-abduct her, and then she'd be in the exact same position I'm in now.
Right.
Because the Japanese legal system is completely unenforceable.
Right.
So that fear keeps her from ever letting me see her. If they had a system that had some backbone, that had some enforcement, then she'd know that I couldn't re-abduct her without penalties.
Mm-hmm.
And she also would know that she couldn't abduct my daughter without penalties.
Mm-hmm.
So then the system would work better if it had enforcement. The fact is it doesn't have enforcement. And that's the biggest problem with the Japanese system. It's a hollow system without any sense of enforcement whatsoever.
What has the State Department done for you, and what can they still do for you and other parents that have had children taken to Japan?
They have offered welfare and whereabouts, welfare and health and comfort visits, I think they call them, where they go and they check on the status of your child, and then they report back to you on how the child is doing. And there was one of those visits that my wife had allowed, and then they recontacted her recently trying to get another visit. They wrote her two letters, and then she had her lawyers contact the embassy in Japan that the embassy was harassing her.
Right.
And, you know, the most funny thing is that she's a U.S. citizen. She's a naturalized U.S. citizen.
How is she allowed to stay in Japan?
Because her mother is Japanese, and her daughter, my daughter, is a dual citizen of both countries.
Okay.
She's a U.S. citizen and a Japanese citizen. So she's got ways, and she probably has a working visa as well. I don't know. I haven't talked to her, but I know when I left Japan, she had no legal status there. But she probably has obtained some kind of legal status since then.
On the 7th of September 2004, I want to share this email that you received from your lead Japanese attorney. He stated to you, and I quote, "As you point out, we are challenged by racism and discrimination of Japanese court every day since we usually represent foreigners. But I know judges become furious if I point out his racism or discrimination. Racism is firmly rooted in Japanese society, and even intelligent people refuses to see their own racism. Almost all Japanese believe foreigners are deteriorating the security of Japanese society, which is wrong according to our crime statistics." And then you have here, he concludes his email by saying, "Please understand your case is not a piece of cake because of the racism and irrationalism of Japan. It may be something like defending Taliban in the U.S. That's very prophetic, and I want you to comment on that.
Well, that's what it was like. I mean, it is just like that, and I felt like that every time I walked into the Japanese courtroom. They have a legal system, but it's a hollow one, and no matter what, things were going to be ruled against me. I mean, almost like I was wasting my time by going there. But I had to go there because it was the only possible avenue I could have to see my daughter. And, you know, as fruitless as it may seem, even those two 30-minute visits I had, the second visit I was allowed to bring a camera with me into the playroom in the courthouse and take a pictures of my daughter, and I have those up in my house, and those are the last pictures I have of her, and those are from three, four years ago. So he's right. He's right. It is a very there's a lot of racism, and that combined with the unenforceability of their system just makes it impossible for foreigners to deal with that system. There's just no way that we can succeed in that system, and there's nothing anybody can do. I mean, the you asked about what the State Department have done. I know Maureen Hardy. I think she's one of the Assistant Secretaries of State. Mm-hmm. She went over and met with some high-level officials in Japan, and they talked, you know, and they talked through some of these issues, but that's about as far as it got. And then she sent us a letter to all the parents who had children abducted to Japan, and saying that they're working the issue, but in reality, and I think I heard in the webcast of Patrick Braden when you had him on last week, and I agree with him that, you know, here Japan is a large trading partner of us. They're a very big security partner of us with national security over in the Far East. And, you know, I don't think the government wants to rock the boat with Japan. You know, it's easy for the government to stand up and spout rhetoric about North Korea, but because they're an enemy, but Japan's a friend, and so you just don't want to bring these cases forward. It might be a little too painful for the government to do that.
And I addressed that again with a daily commentary a couple of days back, where we talk about Vice President Cheney and a trip to Japan. So again, I encourage you all to go to scaredmonkeys.com or scaredmonkeys.com/radio to listen to that commentary, or YouTube. They've put together a slideshow of that commentary. Just put Pretzer, P-R-E-T-Z-E-R, in this search, and you'll see that. Commander, what's next for you?
What's next for me is I've been trying to get a case in the United States. I'm trying to get my divorce case moved in the United States because I don't want to accept that Japanese divorce. I did not participate in it, and I believe, you know, when I was overseas, I'm legally protected overseas as a military member over there, and I deserve to have a divorce case heard here in the States.
Right.
And so I've been working that legally in the state that I had the most ties to while I was over there, which was Washington State. And if I can get a divorce case to move forward in the States, then I can try to enforce that divorce. Enforce either visitation, or if I have custody, enforce the return of my daughter. And then if I can't enforce that and my ex-wife refuses to comply, the State Department has talked about extradition proceedings against her because she is a U.S. citizen.
Okay.
So my case has some possibilities at the end of the road, although not many. But because she's a U.S. citizen, there are some possibilities of extraditing her back to the States. And where other people who are married to Japanese spouses don't have that. I mean, my ex-wife is Japanese, but she's a naturalized U.S. citizen.
The best website for more information, crcjapan.com?
Yes, crcjapan.com is an excellent website. There's another website, crnjapan.com, Children's Rights Network. Both of them have a lot of good information on them. I found out some great things from those websites. Unfortunately, most of the stuff I found out was after the fact. Some other fathers have found stuff out in advance and taken steps to protect their children. Fathers who have Japanese spouses, that things are starting to go bad in their marriage, were able to look into this, find out in advance, and do things to protect their children from an abduction happening. And that's what we really hope to do with this publicity. I mean, I hope to help my case, but I also hope to help all others who are involved in and have the potential of being involved in these cases.
Well, I can guarantee you I'll stay on top of this and stay in contact with you and others and try and give you as much exposure as we can. Commander, thanks for dropping around the show.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
And we'll stay in touch. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Commander Paul Tolan, again, your child's abducted and taken to a foreign land. We got to do something about this. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back.
certain that you love me. Every time you hold me, I'm still not certain that you care. Oh, you keep on saying you really, really love me. Do you speak the same words to someone else when I'm not there? Suspicion torments my heart. Suspicion keeps us apart. Suspicion, why torture me? Every time you call me and tell me we should meet tomorrow, I can't help but think that you're meeting someone else tonight. Why should our romance just keep on causing me such sorrow? Why am I so doubtful whenever you are out of sight? Suspicion torments my heart. Suspicion keeps us apart. Suspicion, why torture me? Tell me if you love me, I beg you, wait a little longer. Wait until I drive all these foolish fears out of my mind. How I hope and pray that our love will keep on growing stronger. Maybe I'm suspicious, cause true love is so hard to find. Suspicion.
Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show for February 15th, 2007. It's always a pleasure to have Tim Miller from Texas Equisearch on with me. Tim, how are you?
Well, I'm getting better. Surgery was pretty rough. And
was it?
Recovery's long, but getting better.
I guess the tough nuts, they're hard to keep down, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess so.
I appreciate you coming on. Let's talk a little bit about the Jody Sanderholm fundraiser that you went to, an important case and something the folks need to hear about.
Well, you know, Equisearch never expects anything in return for what we do. I mean, we've been blessed with donations that get us out on searches, and certainly blessed with the resources and our members. And, you know, Jody case, it kind of hurt us emotionally. We worked with so many cases and missing people, and, you know, they all get to us. The ones that get us the most, of course, are the ones of our young people that don't put themselves in danger, that didn't do anything wrong, and, you know, somebody chose to take her. And, you know, we were real honored when law enforcement called us and asked us if we could come up there and help. And then, of course, we was real proud of the work that we did while we left her in a short period of time. And, you know, and we left, and I just really wanted to meet Jody's family at that time, just to hug their neck and say, you know, I'm sorry.
Sure.
The timing just wasn't right. And so I felt as though that, you know, that case would just go away, and, you know, we'd move on to other cases, which, of course, we did. And last week, we actually got a phone call from up there, and they were putting together a spaghetti dinner at the high school, and it was a Texas Equisearch Appreciation Day.
Wasn't that nice?
And it just warmed my heart. It was just overwhelming last week when I got that phone call to you know, what they were doing, and they said we're certainly hoping somebody, they knew I had that surgery, and they was hoping a representative from Equisearch could be there, and I told them that if I had to walk through snowdrifts, I would be there, because they really wanted to meet Jody's family. And so I didn't know what to expect when we got there, but and Red went with me with Skirt Monkeys.
Right.
Red flew down the night before and spent the night at my house, and it's always so enjoyable to be around him, and he's been so supportive of us, and of course his interest in the Skirt Monkeys and all our missing person cases has been a tremendous asset to us, and again, he's just a joy to be around. And we flew up there and got there. We missed our first flight. I guess we enjoyed our coffee too much yesterday or Tuesday morning. We missed our first flight.
Right.
We got there just on time. and the cafeteria was just jam-packed full. And then Red went to the bathroom, and he came back, and he said, "Tim, you're not going to believe this." He said, "The entire hallway at the school, going all the way to the front door, there's a line with about four people beside each other all the way out there." And so Red and I started figuring it out, and I started figuring out, my God, how many people do we have here? And and we're figuring probably between 1,300 and 1,400 people, and it was just overwhelming. And of course, I sat with Jody's family,
right?
Which are wonderful people, and again, our hearts just went out to them. That you know, why do these bad things happen to good people? And
yeah,
but what the community has done up there, the chief of police is there. Gave me a shirt from our Kansas City Police Department with my name engraved on it and stuff, and they just showed so much appreciation for you know what we did, and you know this just doesn't happen. I'm gonna say in our 6.5 years of existence and in all the searches that we've ever been involved with, I just never anticipated anything like this would ever happen, for an entire town to come together and say thank you. And you know, they had spaghetti dinner, $5 a plate, and they gave me a check for $4,900.
Wow.
And they're going to be sending another check because that was money that they collected before the event. And it these are the things that kind of make it all worthwhile too. I mean, you know, it's not an ego thing, but knowing that people care and people appreciate what we do, and that's what I told them. That I gave a little acceptance speech, and
right,
and I told them that the turnout they had, the support that they gave, meant more than if they would have gave us a winning lotto ticket from the state of Kansas, and just an outpouring of people. It was just amazing. You just would have had to have been there to really appreciate it. And I'm still overwhelmed. I mean, I've not gotten over it yet. It's just, and all of Jody's family that was there. And we met Jody's sister and Jody's brother and the new baby. Jody's sister had a baby 2 days before Jody's disappearance. And Jody was the first person to see that baby. And so there, you know, there's a lot of stories. We sat around and talked about Jody, and it was real bittersweet. Though, I mean, it was so sad why we had to be there. But again, and I just have to applaud law enforcement up there for a small town that they just stopped everything when Jody disappeared. There was no problems with any egos. There was no problems with all the territorial business that the law enforcement agency kind of go through. You know, they called anybody that they thought that could be beneficial in helping find Jody, and we all worked together basically as one in you know, a matter of no. I mean, we found her power underneath the water in less than 30 seconds.
Right.
We put the boat in the water with the sonar equipment, and then you know, people that found her body was everybody was there for one reason, working together, and it showed that it paid off. And of course, they have somebody in custody. And so, you know, there's a community. I want everybody to still keep in their prayers to, you know, help them through this long, painful healing process. And I'm sure they're going to get there. I mean, just such a tight-knit community that I'm sure they're going to make it. But it's just such a tremendous loss for that community by losing Jody.
Exactly. It takes time, and it's recognition, well-deserved, and you proved that a cooperative effort between local law enforcement and yourselves, you didn't get the result that you hoped, but regardless, you got results. Tim, you're always welcome on this program, and I know you're still recovering from your surgery. We're going to let you go, but I appreciate you coming on. We'll talk to you real soon.
Well, Dana, it's always a pleasure when you call, and again, Skirt Monkeys, but you know what they do for all the families and the missing person cases and keeping it out there. And, you know, I think a combination of all of us working together for that one cause is, you know, we are making a small difference, and I think we're going to continue working together, making a bigger difference, and, you know, Skirt Monkeys is
I just can't say enough for what y'all do there, and you know, I'm just honored to be a part of and the support that y'all give. So anytime we can do anything for any of the listeners out there, and we're here to give, and hope nobody needs us, but you know, if that time comes, we're here. We know Spirit Monkeys are here, and I know in the long run we are going to make that difference.
All right. Tim Miller, thank you. Take care, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, Dana. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. Tim Miller from Texas Equisearch. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. One of the biggest forms of animal cruelty, and we've all seen it being made fun of on television shows and movies. You know, the crazy cat lady that lives in every community, that walks down the street and has cats following her, and you see the news stories. But really, when it comes down to it, it's a huge form of animal cruelty. It's a serious mental health problem. And what I thought I'd do tonight is bring on someone from the National Humane Society of the United States, Mary Lou Randorp. She's a PhD. She's the Professional Outreach Coordinator, Animal Fighting and Cruelty Campaign. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, we see this on television and in the movies, and on The Simpsons, one of the most popular cartoons. The kids all see the crazy cat lady that's on there running around, but it's much more than that. It's actually quite a serious issue. It's a mental health problem and a huge form of animal cruelty.
You're absolutely right, and you're right, too, that often it's depicted as something that's kind of humorous and doesn't get into the depth of the problem and how many people it affects, because there can be literally hundreds of animals, even in one situation, in one case that may be affected, might be suffering, need medical care, not get it, have died, suffering from serious, you know, sicknesses. And people who do animal hoarding also tend to do it again. So even when they are discovered and perhaps someone does something about it, they may go to move to another location and do the same thing again. So again, dozens or hundreds of animals can be affected in very serious ways. And not just animals, but also anybody who's living with a hoarder, which sometimes could be an elderly relative or a minor, and certainly, I'm sure they don't make good neighbors.
No, that's for sure.
Often it gets so bad that their home is a public health hazard, and you know, not something you'd want to be around.
I see statistics here that up to 250,000 animals a year are victims of hoarders. And you make a good point. Authorities may step in, the Humane Society, SCPA, police, whoever, and take away the animals, take the person to court, whatever, and they're right back doing it again. Let's talk about the mental health aspect here. Why are they doing such a thing?
I think both people are familiar with the term denial, meaning, you know, you can look at something and don't see it when everybody else can see it. For example, when people are anorectic or, you know, very, very, very thin, when they look in the mirror, they see they're too heavy, even though you can see, all their bones and their cheeks are sunken, but they literally cannot see it. And hoarders have that same kind of blindness where they are in denial and cannot recognize the harm that they're inflicting on animals. And it's hard for those of us who, you know, have no trouble seeing it to realize that it's, you know, this is something they can't do, but evidently they can't. And there's also a certain amount of obsessiveness involved in this behavior, which is just the kind of compulsion or need to continue doing something, in this case, hoarding, taking animals in. So there is a major mental health component. And the other thing that's involved, in addition making the mental health component even slightly more complicated, is that most cases of hoarders are women over 60. And a lot of times the disposition of those cases, you know, eventually winds up with some of the women perhaps being confined to some kind of institutional care or oversight because there may be cognitive impairment or organic brain dysfunction or, you know, a decline in cognitive abilities. So that also could be associated with it.
Some of the medical issues as far as the animals go, open sores, cancers, dental eye diseases, malnutrition, you name it.
I know. And there was a case recently, I think, I forget what state it was in, but there were 75 women collected chihuahuas, and there was a fire, and I think 75 of them perished. And the ones that they could save, or before that they had never gotten out of their cage and their had never had their toenails clipped, so they couldn't walk because their toenails had grown around into their pads of their feet. So any, you know, kind of horrible thing that you can imagine might happen when an animal is secluded from anybody with good sense and over long periods of time could happen, and it's quite horrific.
What is the Humane Society doing to try and help with this serious problem?
Well, there, our companion animal section works on this area, too, and my colleague Kim Intino addresses this problem by directly working with shelters on it. And the Humane Society of the United States basically can help in two ways. It, like I mentioned, Kim, they provide expert advice on these cases to, you know, local shelters who have to prepare, because that's the other thing. You can imagine being the animal shelter and you have to deal with the case of receiving, you know, 100 incoming animals in various states of great kind of medical need. The other thing HSUS has done is they sometimes will go directly into the community to provide, to give direct assistance when there's a very large hoarding case. And HSUS has produced a video called Animal Hoarding, a Community Task Force Solution, which kind of outlines the major points that we're talking about right now. And there is a web link for getting to this information. Would you like me to give it to you?
Sure.
www.animalsheltering.org/animal hoarding
Okay.
Those are more resources.
Some communities have placed limits on animal possession. For example, local bylaws that say that you're only allowed to have three cats or two dogs. Do you think that that is a way of trying to control the hoarding problem, or is that just a Band-Aid solution and a hoarder is going to do it regardless?
I don't know, and my guess would be that the hoarder would do it regardless. So I'm not sure how effective those laws are, but I also understand the impulse in trying to do something and why those laws may come into effect, but probably it would be wise when making any kind of law like that to consult with a variety of people, including the people who deal with elders and animal services and others, to get a good sense of what, you know, if this would be a good solution to the problem.
We've got a few minutes left here, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the animal fighting cruelty campaign that the Humane Society of the United States is working on.
Well, certainly. Animal cruelty and animal fighting is one of the kind of major forms of animal abuse, and there has been success in the last 10 to 15 years in getting both society in general and law enforcement and others to recognize this as an important problem. Animal cruelty and animal fighting. Animal fighting is basically a particular form of animal cruelty, as is, for example, hoarding. And animal cruelty and animal fighting, there are now 42 states that have felony provisions in their state animal cruelty laws, and that in 1990 there were only seven. So you can see the rapid increase, and that is due to the recognition that when there is animal cruelty occurring and when there is animal fighting occurring in communities, there are lives at risk, certainly the animals, but also children in the home, sometimes other members of the family, and certainly members of the community, and that these kind of activities coexist with other kinds of criminal activity, whether it's drug use, use of weapons, you know, or just, you know, all the different kinds of crime that you can imagine, including, you know, interpersonal violence or violence against humans. So with this kind of recognition that animal cruelty isn't something that's just kind of like a parallel thing that happens in paralleling, you know, kind of the human society, it's embedded in, we're all embedded together and interacting with one another. So animal cruelty is a public health and community safety issue for everybody.
With the internet today, with websites like YouTube and others, where people for some strange reason like to go and put their crimes that they've recorded on the internet for all to see, yet there doesn't seem to be any sort of regulation as far as prohibiting that. Does the Humane Society of the United States have investigators that look into these sorts of things? Say, an animal hoarder who decides to put a video of themselves on the internet, or someone who is bragging about their pit bull fights that they hold every Wednesday night?
Well, yes, the HSUS does have a very important investigative services, and I know about it, but I, you know, am not involved with it. But they are continually performing investigations of animal fighting and animal cruelty and cockfighting, and seeking ways to intervene, both, you know, with new laws, but also by having the people that should be arrested and dealt with.
Your message for someone who lives next door to an animal hoarder. The neighbors all complain amongst themselves because of the smell and because of the cats or dogs that are in their garbage every day, but they don't really know what to do.
Well, the first, if there is any kind of, you know, animal service agency or humane society nearby, certainly contact them. But as is the case so often with animal hoarding, there are a lot of agencies that have to get involved. And one would be public health. The other would be the housing authorities, because surely, you know, there's been some codes that are not being followed. And also law enforcement, to see what else is going on in that family. So they may have to, and maybe should, try a number of different agencies to make sure that they get an adequate response.
Dr. Randor, Professional Outreach Coordinator, Humane Society of the United States, thank you. I would like to stay in touch with your organization and do some more shows, because it's very important. As an animal lover myself, I don't think the mainstream media does enough work as far as protecting animals, and we need to step up on that. Just stay on the line for a minute, and I'll talk to you in a second. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. And you are listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back with the managing editor of Dario, Jossie Manser.
It's Friday night, and I'd slopped the hogs. I went to the house and I fed the dog, and I went inside to relax and watch TV. I was flipping through the channels hoping to catch an old Western movie or a wrestling match, but all I could get was the news on NBC. So I picked up the paper and I seen this ad, and it went on and on how the latest fad could satisfy my ever dreaming wish. It had a toll-free number that a man could call, 2-week trial at no charge at all. I could watch TV on my very own satellite dish. Well, the truck pulled up the very next morning. Looked like it had a flying saucer on it. From the sign on the door, I could see it was Satellite Joe.
Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We have some updates or some breaking news out of Aruba in regards to the Paulus Vandersloot lawsuit. Again, try and say that three times real fast. Against Aruba. And some interesting information that came out of there. And I thought, why not go to the best source in Aruba, the man who knows the information, what's going on, Jossie Manser, managing editor of Dario. Jossie, how are you this evening?
Pretty good, sir. Thank you.
Nice to have you back on the program again. You're always welcome here. There's some news on the Holloway case, in particular the lawsuit that Paulus had filed against Aruba. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, he won in the first instance in the lower courts. He won a reward for about 40,000 guilders.
Right.
That's close to $22,000. And then the prosecution appealed the case, but Paulus also appealed the case because he wanted more money. He considered that he wasn't rewarded strongly enough.
Okay.
And Friday we had the sentence of the Superior Court of Justice that told him he's not going to get 1 cent. The sentence did not favor him absolutely. But it also brought forward a few points that most of us weren't aware of, no?
Okay, let's share some of those points. They're very, very interesting.
Yeah, one of the points is that Paulus on the float in a tapped, not taped, but a tapped conversation on the phone admitted that he had picked up Joran, his son, and Natalie at the McDonald's at the Palm Beach, at the northern tip of the island. We didn't know that. We knew he picked up a son, but very few people knew that he picked up Natalie with Joran. Now, this came out in the sentence of the Superior Court that he had contact with her on two occasions the same night that she disappeared. Now, that's very interesting, and it puts some kind of new angle to the case, because we weren't aware that on that day, that night, he had any kind of personal contacts with Natalie specifically.
Right. And part of the ruling says, with attention to the lying declarations that the son of Paulus, Joran Andres Petrus Vandersloot, hereafter Joran, gave about his last contact on the 30th of May 2005 with the disappearance of Natalie Holloway, the suspicion is not unreasonable that he made himself guilty of a conduct that can be qualified as murder, manslaughter, or the kidnapping that resulted in the death. The possible involvement of Paulus with that could then be deducted from the file with the official reports of the witnesses, amongst which two people suggest a contact existed between Paulus and Natalie Holloway the night of her disappearance, and a tap report that was given by the prosecutor in her final note to the court. Let's talk a little bit, Yossi, about that apparent pitcher. We go back to the casino, and there was always the talk of a pitcher of someone that sure looked like Paulus sitting beside Natalie. This brings kind of a whole new light to that now, doesn't it?
It sure does. It means that he did have contact with her, not only at the casino table, but at some other point and some place else. Now, the sentence doesn't specify where. It specifies one of the contacts that he had, but he had two contacts with her, according to the sentence. Now, the second contact, we don't know where it took place, neither do we know at what time it took place. But it's very interesting that the Superior Court of Justice now brings forth an information that only the prosecution had in its power, no, in its possession. And I imagine that the prosecution never revealed any of this to the public because they were saving it for the case that they have to bring to court yet.
And you think with this new information, it would now complicit or make Paulus Vandersloot more complicit in this whole matter, and maybe he should have spent some more time in jail than he actually did.
That is my opinion also. I don't know why he was asking for money. I mean, how can you reward someone that is so deeply involved in the disappearance and possible murder of a young girl that visited Aruba with her classmates just to have fun and to say goodbye to one period of her life to begin the next one? But that the next period was taken away from her very, very brutally, and now she has disappeared. We're almost certain she is dead, and we think that she met an untimely death and a very cruel one at that.
With this information now out there, has there been any comment from the prosecutor, from the police?
No, none whatsoever, because Karen Jansen, as you know, left.
Right.
We don't know who took her place yet and how deeply involved he or she will be in this case. And the police are very silent on the case at this moment. But I'm sure that they must have paid close attention to this case also. In other words, the revelation of this information that was always in the files of the prosecution. And now the Superior Court brought it out in a sentence against Paulus van der Sloot.
This brings out more concern from everyone as far as a complicity or a cover-up by the government of Aruba to try and set this whole investigation aside, and in fact very early on try to blame some security guards that obviously had nothing to do with this. Now that this has come out, and it makes it even more certain and almost puts the nail in the coffin as far as a cover-up goes, what do you think the next steps will be, Josie?
No, it's very hard to say, because I don't know how deeply involved and how far they have progressed in Holland with all the documentations and video tapes and audio tapes that they took with them. I don't know what the Dutch team is doing with the case at this point. It would largely depend on what actions they plan to take, especially with this new information that has come to light and has become public, that I'm sure the prosecution has had in its files for a long time.
And these phone taps on Paulus' phone, this may be just a small part of what was actually heard. Do you know of any other efforts in Aruba as far as a search for remains or any kind of an additional investigation, or are things on that front fairly quiet?
Well, it's quiet to a point. I know that at the present time there is a crew here from Court TV doing quite some filming and interviews and other stuff related to this case. I think it's in preparation for some kind of a program they plan to put out at some time in the future. Mm-hmm. But things are going on here with the case. The case is in depth. We haven't pleased the government with that. I mean, we didn't turn our backs on this case like they wanted us to make it disappear. No way. We'll go all the way with this case until we find the answers we are looking for.
I'm not sure if you can comment, Josie, or not, but some lawsuits against Dario have been dismissed.
Yes. Yes, the lawsuits that the Attorney General started against me and against Diario, because we were honest enough to tell her publicly that she was being led by the nose by the minister, that she let some political influence interfere with her job, and that the only thing that could cause is the loss of faith on the part of the public in the administration of justice in Aruba, and an administration that was already under severe questioning due to this case.
And because you told the truth, the lawsuit has been dismissed. Has there been any discussion or any retraction from the government?
No, none whatsoever. But we won the case, and now the Attorney General has to take her leave. I mean, she has to quit her job. Or the government should send her home and name someone else that can build up back the confidence that has been lost and the impartial administration of justice in Aruba.
Yeah, the confidence has been lost, and the confidence of Aruba itself worldwide has been in question and lost. And the confidence in you, sir, has not been lost. You're always welcome on the program, and thanks for dropping around with the update.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Josie. Good night.
Good night.
Josie Mansour, managing editor of Dario, here tonight to talk about Paulus van der Sloot. We'll be back in a minute and take a couple of calls before we end up. You are listening to Scared Monkeys Radio.
Somebody
Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. I didn't think I could spit that out. My name is Dana Pretzer. Get the sock out of my mouth. If you'd like to call in and comment on anything any of my guests had to say this evening, it's 1-306-842-7884. 1-306-842-7884. And, of course, I want to thank all my guests for joining me this evening and remind you our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen to tonight's show as a podcast, other shows, daily commentaries, listen live. You can listen to past shows without downloading them. You can do everything you want at scaredmonkeys.com/radio. And, of course, the creme de la creme of blogs is scaredmonkeys.com. Just take the slash radio out of there and go to scaredmonkeys.com for news and views and reviews and you name it. We've been doing a lot of the daily commentaries as YouTube shows also. And go to YouTube and just put Scared Monkeys in the search engine, or Pretzer, P-R-E-T-Z-E-R, or Z-E-R if you're in Canada. And there you can pick up some of the daily commentaries. They've been doing a great job putting those with slides together on YouTube. So, again, just to remind you that we try to do a weekly show, or at least twice a week, here on the Dana Pretzer Show, and we do the daily commentary, and we appreciate any feedback that you can give us. Again, thanks to all my guests this evening, and we will be back with you sometime next week here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Thank you, everyone. Good night.